Good morning. Welcome to the Addiction Professional Panel Series. My name is Jennifer Turning. I'm the Vice President of Custom Programs for Addiction Professional. Thank you all for joining us today and braving the rain outside. Today's topic is family dynamics and addiction treatment. We have a very impressive panel of experts ready to weigh in, but first I have some housekeeping notes that they make me read. Today's program is eligible for one continuing education credit. You should have received a certificate of participation upon arrival. If not, please visit the registration desk on your way out. Please complete the evaluation form that you'll find at your place setting. This evaluation form allows us to offer continuing education credit, so it's important. It also, we like to improve our program whenever we can, so we appreciate your honest feedback. For those of you who registered for today's program in advance, you should have received a $25 American Express gift card on your way in. If you did not, please check with the folks at registration and we'll get that straightened out for you. In deference to our sponsors today, please refrain from passing out any promotional materials or literature. And for those of you who tweet, are there any Twitter users out there? There's always one. In case there is, for those of you who tweet, today's hashtag is AP Series, all one word. Today's event is made possible by four sponsors who are outstanding supporters of the recovery community. Dominion Diagnostics is our 2016 Panel Series Thought Leadership Partner, and Foundations Recovery Network is our 2016 Panel Series sponsor. Both are supporting this educational series in cities across the country. Today's program is also sponsored by Pine Grove and Mirror Lake Recovery Center. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our panelists. I'm just going to give you a brief intro to each of our four panelists. They are all incredibly experienced, credentialed professionals, and I would be up here for a long time if I were to read their full bios. First, it's my pleasure to introduce Stephanie Fultz. She joins us today courtesy of Dominion Diagnostics. She is currently the Director of Marketing at Journey Pure. She believes in creating an environment for collaboration with other providers to ensure the best clinical placement for those seeking treatment. Beth Johnson, would you like to say a few words about Dominion? Lori has a microphone right behind you.
Hi, I'm Beth Johnson. I'm with Dominion Diagnostics. We are a urine drug testing lab, and we've been around since 1997, and we are proud to be a partner with Addiction Professional Panel Series, and I would like to introduce Stephanie Fultz, who is the director of our marketing director of Journey Pure. So thank you.
Thank you, Beth. Glenda Murray joins us today courtesy of Foundations Recovery Network. She is a therapist at the Oaks at La Paloma. She utilizes a variety of therapeutic modalities with patients, including her level 2 training in EMDR and in-depth training on deployment spectrum issues facing military service members and their family. John Fisher, would you like to say a few words about Foundations?
Absolutely. My name is John Fisher. I'm the Memphis representative for Foundations Recovery Network. Many of you may be familiar with us. We have the Oaks at La Paloma as our residential facility here in town. We also have five other residential facilities across the country, some out west, some in Georgia. We have a new facility in Michigan, Skywood Recovery, which is a 100-bed facility. We treat integrated mental health and substance abuse treatment, both in a residential and an outpatient setting. We also have an intensive outpatient here in Memphis, which is in a separate location at Poplar and 240 with morning and evening programming.
Thanks, John. Caroline Smith is the Director of Intensive Workshops at Pine Grove. She is a licensed professional counselor, certified sexual addiction therapist supervisor, and certified multiple addiction therapist. She is EMDR trained and holds clinical experience in the areas of trauma resolution, relationship attachment patterns, addiction interaction disorder, and the two most primary process addictions, food and sex. Teresa, would you like to say a few words about Pine Grove?
Good morning. Pine Grove is a comprehensive treatment facility. We're an extension of Forest General Hospital that has been around since 1984. We do sex addiction, chemical for both male and female. We have a 55-plus treatment facility for 55-plus chemical dependency, and we have a professional enhancement program. If you have someone you really don't know where they belong, we also have an evaluation center. Of course, Caroline works with our intensive workshops, and thank you this morning.
Thanks, Teresa. Walter Williams joins us today courtesy of Mirror Lake Recovery Center. He is the Executive Director at First Step and Mid-South Sober Living. Mr. Williams' background includes sales and marketing, along with 22 years of experience in alcohol and drug treatment, Program Design, Development, and Administration. Jan Brucker, would you like to say a few words about Mirror Lake?
Got you right here. Thank you. As Jennifer said, my name is Jan Brucker. I'm the Regional Clinical Liaison for Mirror Lake Recovery Center, which used to be called New Life Lodge. So perhaps some of y'all are familiar with New Life Lodge. We treat adults age 18 and above for all types of substance abuse, including detox and residential, and important to keep in mind because it's sometimes hard to find. We do treat pregnant women, and we also treat the medically fragile patient, given that our medical director is an internal medicine physician as well as a certified addictionologist. So thank you, and thank you for having us, and Walter, thanks for doing this for us.
Thank you to all of our sponsors for their support. Now the good stuff, what brought you all here today. I am going to pick on you first, Caroline. Okay. How has the thinking around family dynamics in addiction recovery evolved over the past few years?
I think the last decade, being the decade of the brain, has really given us a lot more evidence and science around this disease. And I think one of the greatest studies never told is the ACE study, Adverse Childhood Experiences. And if someone has an ACE score of 4 or more, they're 30% more likely to have alcoholism. And so when we look at the family system, I know sometimes we joke that we would rather have the patient come to family week and the family actually in treatment. Sometimes the person that shows up to be treated is maybe the healthiest one in the family. So I think the emerging brain science can lead the intervention in the family system. The system is the identified patient. And so the more we know about attachment theory, we can help the family system. It's not blame. It's about discovery, acceptance, and freedom.
And Glenda, how has addiction and the family's role in addiction treatment changed over the course of your practice?
Over the course of time, families have become more and more important to the recovery process. I feel that I agree with what she said, that we are coming to a greater awareness of the family system's role in the situation. I'm a firm believer personally that every family has dysfunction. It's just a matter of how much of dysfunction that entity has. I think it all starts with our language. If we change the language that we use and educate families that you're in this together so the healing comes together, then we have a greater possibility of a higher outcome of positive change in people's lives.
And Stephanie, have you seen a change in the way that family issues are approached during treatment?
Absolutely. I think at the very beginning there was a lot of psychoeducational information handed out to families, and I know that from my experience in within Journey Peer, one of the things that we do is really kind of bring them in and have them part of the process, and not just educating them about addiction, but really understanding what their role is as in the family system. One of the techniques that we use a lot of experiential therapy, and we have found, like with equine therapy, that really opens the family up. And so we incorporate equine therapy into our family program. It's where they aren't just telling a story about their family, but they're really kind of living through it and being able to recognize and maybe accept some of the challenges they have within their family system, and recognize that with the horse versus sitting in a chair and kind of having some of those guards up when speaking with the patient right there. So really kind of changing the atmosphere in which we're doing family therapy and in incorporating that in. And then I also feel like it gives them a bird's eye view into what their loved one is experiencing in treatment as well, and are really getting to kind of feel those emotions behind it. And I think it connects us from that perspective.
Anyone else want to weigh in?
I'd like to add that I think it's really important that we start on the front end. The earlier we can get families involved in the treatment process, other than just pulling up to a driveway, dropping off at a door and saying, here you go, I'm leaving my problem with you. If we can get the families connected on the front end, then that's going to start that process sooner.
Carolyn?
I really agree with what Stephanie said as well, that cognitive information alone is not enough. If it was, we could just buy a book and we wouldn't need treatment or therapy. So no matter which modality is used, evidence shows that it's the connection to the caregiver. That's a temporary attachment bridge that is necessary for the brain's development of creating earned secure attachment. So it's a top-down, bottom-up process for the system.
So, Walter, you and I talked a little bit before the session. Your background is slightly different in that your client population is different. And I'll let you elaborate a little bit more on that. But you and I were talking about, you know, families by birth and families by choice, and including those families by choice and non-traditional families and families made up of friends. Talk a little bit about bringing those groups into the treatment process.
Yeah, the population I deal with is, in the whole 22 years I've been in this field, is 85% of them are from the criminal justice system. So when they've reached that point, the most family relationships and ties are well broken years prior. So they have family of choice or friends of choice. And what we'd like to do is at first identify who's safe and who is not in their family, if they still have any connections with family, and get them involved. What we believe is at admission and discharge. With the population I deal with, there's not, and the funding we have, which is state funding, we don't bill insurance, we don't bill Humana and Cigna, so we there is no funding from the federal government for family therapy. So that provides a struggle for us and for our counselors. We do open our doors every single time somebody does want to come in for family counseling, and we love that when that happens, but that's a bonus for us when we get that. But identify who's safe and who's not. Let the family members know that this is a lifelong process, and this may sound awful, but to dumb it down a little bit, lower their expectations when they complete treatment, they're not going to come out a changed person. They're just really starting this process. Relapse is part of it. And don't try to manage this patient. For the patient, though, you know, your mom, your brother, is your spouse, is not your sponsor. That's not your counselor. You need to take care of yourself. And when I got in recovery years ago, one of the best things I learned was from my sponsor. I kept saying, my mom, my sisters, they're just kind of not responding. There's no trust there. He said, well, because you keep telling them, I've changed. He said, quit talking it and just live it. And what I got from that was 3 years later, I have two sisters. One called me and said, so how do I get an AA? And then 2 years after that, the third one, my other sister called. So we're all in recovery. And, you know, I quit trying to, they had to lower, the trust was just not there. And it takes years for that to come back. So we really like to, when we get a chance, role play with family members, but really give realistic expectations on both sides. And what is not your role for both the patient and the family member.
That reminds me of the saying, you know, blood is thicker than water. Well, love is thicker than blood. And sometimes the family of choice is much healthier. And I really believe that the 12-step fellowships are the ultimate attachment repair system, because someone is seen, soothed, and safe in that environment.
Stephanie?
Very well said. You know, I really agree with that aspect of it. And I think in our programming, as we all move forward, that having that 12-step base that has really created the foundation for, as we've moved forward in recovery and treatment, envelopes the family as well. And having family support systems for the family, just like we do for the addict, is essential if we are going to, you know, move forward in a space of healing and recovery.
Glenda, you mentioned the importance of starting right at the beginning with families. What are some techniques that you've used to bring families together at the beginning of the treatment process, both traditional and non-traditional family units?
Wow, that's a loaded question. First of all, let me just kind of get it out there because it helped my nervousness. This is the first time I've ever done this, so I'm like scared to death up here. So
you're
just take
great.
A let me just take a deep breath here for just a second. I'm very much a firm believer that support in whatever fashion it comes in is the most valuable thing. There's a reason why we say it takes a village to raise a child. It's no different, really. We just compare that to those who suffer with addiction and mental health issues, and I firmly believe that everyone who has an addiction has some sort of mental health issue, whether it's diagnosable or not, and vice versa. Research supports that mental health issues are a primary reason why most people struggle with addiction, no matter what format that comes in, whether it's substance abuse or watching television. Everything can be taken out of context and out of control and out of balance. That being said, and I may have digressed from your question, some of the things that I use to get families involved on the front end is just, to be honest, simple English. You know, I am who I am, and I don't pretend to be someone I'm not. And I think it's imperative that we recognize that most of these families don't understand a lot of therapy ease. They don't understand a lot of psychological ease. They don't understand words like family systems. I think the primary place to start is just saying, hey, you're in love together, you're in hurt together. There's not really much difference. And you have to start somewhere. One of the obstacles that I find is so many families come in. I'm also a therapist who leads the Family Weekend program. So many families come in and say, it's a choice, it's a choice, it's a choice. And we have to get them to understand that maybe it's more of a disease of choice. Somehow they're robbed of the ability to make the proper choices to live a healthy life. So I think on the front end, we just really have to build that connection. Research shows that the relationship is the most vital part, whether that relationship's with your patient or whether your patient is the family as a whole. Support can come in any way you see it. Anyone you'll listen to, anyone who has a healthy connection to you, and just try to recreate those bridges. I agree with what Walter said. Not only can criminality cause a breakdown in the family, long-term addiction, long-term mental health issues causes a breakdown in the family, and trust is broken. And one of the things that we tell our patients and our families over Family Weekend is we use a barometer. Before you got here, treatment was minus 20, below zero. And when you leave here, you're just at zero. And you have to start there and work your way up.
Now, you're doing such a good job, and this is your first time. You said something that I want to follow up on. You mentioned that, you know, this is a disease of choice. What are some of the ways that you get the families to understand?
Oh, absolutely. It's called Pleasure Unwoven DVD by Kevin McCauley. It's a vital resource, and we show it to our family members every month. We refer, if families cannot come to our Family Weekend program, we ask them. Now, you may want to be careful and ask your families to not just Google Pleasure Unwoven, because there's no telling what might come up, okay? That's an important part, and believe it or not, we tell them that just that way. But that is a vital resource. To have that outside third party that's not connected to La Paloma or foundations or any of these other facilities, someone who's walked the walk, like Walter said, being in recovery, who said, you know, I did my own research and this is what I found. And it never fails every month. Actually, tomorrow starts our Family Weekend program. Saturday by noon, I'm going to hear a lot of people go, aha. That it's really an eye-opening. So that's definitely a must-have. Must-have in your toolbox. Pleasure Unwoven by Kevin McCauley. You can buy it for around $35 on Amazon.com.
And Caroline, what are some other strategies and techniques that you've used to incorporate
the
families?
Well, you're talking about the family program, the group. I think having group universality is so important for family members because, you know, this whole, our family, this is embarrassing. You know, if somebody has a loved one that has cancer, their support group is going to be notified and they'll have a bunch of casseroles. But if somebody has a family member that has an addictive disorder, they try to keep, I mean, it's there's still such a stigma and taboo that it's secret. And so to be in a group with other families that have the same thing happening is great shame reduction. It's very empowering, that connection with other people that understand. So I agree with you. I think the family group is very, very important. And I had also written down that DVD by Dr. Kevin McCauley. He has a new one that's out as well. I wouldn't have your people go to YouTube to watch it because it's the one that they would watch there is very abbreviated. But it's excellent. And our families have stress. You know, the CDC says the leading cause of workplace disability in America right now, mental health issues. So I think it's really important to assess family members and to offer them support for the issues that they're dealing with. Our culture really celebrates some very damaging strategies to this dis-ease in a family. And so they deserve truth and support as well during this time.
So I just have a follow-up question to that. How do you not shift the focus away from the person who's there to enter into recovery when you're focusing on the family and all of those adjacent issues?
Right. Often the person that comes to treatment feels like their family just wants them fixed. You know, their family's tired of it. They feel embarrassed that they kept trying to do their best, but they kept failing. One thing that I do is I start with everybody in the room drawing a picture of their childhood, an emotion of when they felt fear, loneliness, shame, anger. And if family members can see the other family members had events in their childhood that they had these emotions. And that might be the first time that a son hears dad actually experience and express a time when he had pain or fear or shame. So to create those connections of universality.
Did you want to weigh in?
Just listening to this, it reminds me of a story, of course, this week. Saw a guy sitting, you know, behind the bench, smiling like he had won. He had beat the treatment center and the court and everything. But, I mean, he spent the night in jail last night, and he's probably not going to get out for a while. But he had this smile on his face like, you know, I got them. And I was like, oh, you know, don't you get it? You didn't win. And the guy I dealt with yesterday, and we're going to deal again with Friday, who was obviously impaired but just really couldn't provide a urine screen. But the success stories 2 years ago, and I love stories like this, had a guy I grew up with, he's my age, and he pulled me aside at a function and said, are you still doing the alcohol and drug mental health treatment? I said, yeah. He said, you know, my son, he's in university, he's at Texas, and we had some problems, and we got him in treatment, and he said, you know, they have this, on this campus, they have this collegiate recovery thing, and so he got involved in that, and he goes to these, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, you've heard of that? And I said, yes. He said, you know, I went and bought that book because I wanted to read what is this my son's going to. And occasionally when he calls, I don't do it all the time. I just say, you know, in that book the other night, son, I was reading this page, da-da-da, and it's kind of changed how I deal with people at work and whatever. So I said, that's perfect. Don't change anything you're doing. You know, just to hear somebody supporting from a distance but not trying to control. And it's not... All this is not rocket science. It's things like that that make the difference.
I'd like to add another resource, if I may. HeroesInRecovery.com, Foundation Recovery Network, is a sponsor of that. It's a nationwide movement that, and it's you can go on the internet and access for your and ask your families to do so. There's thousands of stories on there from not only patients but from their family members. It's a fantastic resource to let them know I'm not alone. And it's meant, created to change the stigma around addiction and mental health issues. And we do have a 6K a week from Saturday here in Memphis, so please feel free to sign up or encourage your loved ones to sign up for that as well.
Yeah, Heroes in Recovery is a great program. I think we might even have some plastic wristbands if anybody would like some. You know, Caroline and Walter both touched on this a little bit, Stephanie, just in terms of, you know, Walter mentioned his sisters, and we're talking about patterns of behavior. How can a clinician best work with clients and their families to break patterns of behaviors that impede long-term recovery?
You know, I think it's very similar to the approach that we're working with the patient of the collaboration of bringing people in. I don't think, I know that every family system has dysfunction, but I don't think every family system is the same. And this is where I'm a big believer in individualized treatment programming, creating programming to the family as well, having resources available for the needs of what that family is. I mean, we have patients that come in that have folks spread out across the U.S., but that are also, you know, contained within in this person's recovery and of how do we bring them all together and can't physically get them into one place. And so of having a whole group of resources to use, I'm also a really big believer in finding programs for families. Intensive workshops, excuse me, there's several that can be utilized. You guys have a great one here in Memphis, the Experiential Healing Center that can work with families. In Bowling Green, Kentucky, we do a lot with the Bridge to Recovery is a great resource. Pine Grove has family support on-site workshops. I mean, there's a slew of facilities that are short-term, week-long programs that the family can really kind of dive into. And I really feel like if they're doing that work at the same time that their loved one's doing the work, that then they can come together in your family program and not be bringing as much baggage in. So I think there's a lot of resources. One of the things we also are doing and will roll out in the next week or two is our recovery coaching app. We currently have it, but now we've integrated in where the family can be part of that process and of working with the client. And we offer a year support for our clients because it doesn't end the minute they leave the door. Where the family can be connected, the clinical team can be connected, the recovery coach is part of that, and really of creating more of a long-term support system versus just, you know, your family weekend or, you know, your 30-day treatment model.
There's a lot of that. There's a lot in your answer that I want to come back to.
Okay.
But first I'm going to circle back to Caroline and talk about breaking patterns of behavior within families.
Mark Twain once said, you can't throw a bad habit out the window. You have to coax it down the stairs one step at a time. And I think, you know, the doctors, the PHP programs, they have 5 years of accountability, monitoring, support, and so they have over 90% success rates. That's what all people deserve and need. So to be able to build in for the family, and I'm not going to do any advertising here, but I do know of a company that benchmarks families against other families as far as their involvement in 12-step programs, in treatment for them in specific issues that was assessed. And it's like the Press Ganey. If you're part of a hospital, you get Press Ganey scores and you're benchmarked against other hospitals or other mental health facilities. It's very motivating. But to have that built-in structure, and you were saying that you have a year after, I think that's so important for the family members as well to have that support, monitoring, and structure.
You know, Mark Twain also said, quitting smoking's easy. I've done it dozens of times.
I know you're not doing any advertising, but just so the members of our audience can look at that resource if they'd like to, do you mind sharing?
Southworth Associates.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And since you nice segue, you and Stephanie both touched on technologies mm-hmm. that are really changing the way families are integrated into the treatment and recovery process. What are some other ways that technology has worked? I know not everybody, Glenda, can, I'm sure, attend your weekend family program. Do you use Skype or other types of technologies to incorporate those long distance families?
I know a lot of our people that discharge, they stay connected with other patients through the web. We have a private web. And I'm over 60, I don't even know what this stuff is called, but they have this private web thing that they go into and, you know, talk with each other.
Chat room.
Thank you. I don't even do Facebook. But can I just say one thing, that the whole culture, the web-based culture, the social networking stuff, is being used to undermine our families. Let me just give you one statistic on that. Porn sites have more visitors every month than Netflix, Amazon, and Twitter combined. Do you know the number one search on the web for pornography is for underage teenage pornography? That's the number one site that's searched for. Porn sites today are not what they used to be. The average, well, when asked young children, females, when did they start using pornography sites, the average was at age 10. Two-thirds of our youth under the age of 16 are already having sex in America. So this whole porn exploitation is really impacting. We have a tsunami coming our direction of intensity, very little intimacy. And the glue that holds systems together is that intimacy, which is built on truth, trust, and that's being shattered right now because of technology in many ways.
You mentioned, you know, children being affected by process addiction. And I don't know, at age 10, if we refer to it as a process addiction, but that's what it is. What do you say to parents, and I realize that none of you work specifically with an adolescent population solely, but what do you say to parents who are bringing their child into treatment for substance use, process addiction, et cetera? What do you say to them when they say, well, it's their problem, not mine? And Glenda, I'm going to toss that question to you. Because I'm sure you've never heard that.
You want the professional answer, right?
sorry. The swear words here.
Little humor there, okay. Well, one of the things I have to do that I do personally is just remind the family again, like I said earlier, remind the family you're in this together. Mom, you're impacted. Dad, you're impacted. Brothers and sisters are impacted. Friends are impacted, those relationships. And so we have to get them to a place where it's not like them versus us. You know, I believe in the terminology of I need to be a good me and you need to be a good me, but we need to be a good us or a good we together. And so I think you just have to start with basic, even though I don't think psychoeducation is the entire answer, but I do think it has a foundational, a very important role in that aspect.
And how do you kind of address issues of codependency and enabling with your families in treatment?
Well, one of the things I do start out with is I ask my patients, or if I'm doing a group, how many of you have adult parents who are having a substance abuse problem? And when half the room or over half the room raises their hand and say, well, I'm just going to go ahead and tell you right now to get you codependent no more, because research shows that adult children of alcoholics tend to be codependent. Ask people how are they tired of being a doormat. They're tired of being a welcome mat where people walk all over them. What kind of issues do you set aside yourself and allow other people to take advantage of you? So most people, believe it or not, in my opinion, in addiction and issue would they have addiction issues suffer from some level of codependency. And so I just sort of, you know, if you want to call it cause and effect or correlation, whatever word you want to use, I let them know this is a symptom of what you're struggling with, just like a symptom of maybe lying or building a world of distrust. And so if in order to get to where you want to be and have a healthy life, you have to start with those relationships, because you have to have those relationships in order to live a healthy life. And so you have to start with that.
Caroline?
Codependency is two ticks and no dog. If, you know, if you have a couple that, you know, one has an addiction, and it's not fair to say one is codependent. Co means they both have insecure attachment issues, and they're just two sides of the same coin. So I think that's all I have to say at this point.
Walter?
I have a personal story on codependency. So, you know, when being in recovery, never knew when I was 7 years old I was going to grow up and work in the addiction mental health field. I think it was assumed I would grow up, get married, and have kids, which I did. So when I was 7 years old, I was with my grandfather in the Boot Hill, Missouri, and he said, you want to watch these chickens, the chickens are getting ready to hatch. So I'm sitting there, a little 7-year-old boy with my grandfather, and I'm watching this egg move around, and it starts cracking, and you see this little wet being in there, alive, struggling like the Dickens, poking to get out of that egg. And I said, oh, I got to help it. And I reached in and he goes, no, don't help it. It'll be crippled. You can't do that. It's got to get out on its own. And I, Paul, you got to, and I kept asking. He said, well, you can go ahead and do it, but it's going to be crippled. Don't mess it up. I cracked the rest of the egg open. And for the next 6 months, I went up there. I saw that chicken walking around in the yard, you know, with, you know, crippled, literally. So that hurt. It may sound corny, but as I grew up and I thought about that, so when it came to my kids, which was a lot harder than my addiction, to not enable them. Now that was a lot harder than dealing with me. I would go back to that story and that pain and go, okay, I'm not doing that to my son, to my daughter. I think anything you can use, the more we know about, the reason I say that, the more we know about our family and about the patients and give them some kind of tools. I mean, we've got to use our evidence-based practices, all the things we said, but there are some things that you can still just bring it back to something that's really real and they can sink their teeth into.
And Walter, what do you think the family's role in aftercare support is?
In aftercare support, in a perfect world, I would love it if we had most of all our safe family members involved. Again, as I'd said, we don't have funding for that. And I'm not a clinician. I'm in administration. But what I try to do is as often as we can, and family members come in, we set up realistic expectations that your child, your spouse, the chances are they're going to relapse through this. They need to be working their program. Just really talk about day-to-day and how do they see. Don't wake up in the morning and say, are you going to your meeting tonight? Why did you miss counseling last week? You know, don't micromanage. They need to do this on their own. Just, as we said earlier, dumb it down. Just talk about real day-in and day-out stuff.
And Stephanie, did you have something you wanted to add?
I think in the aftercare planning, too, of really putting a solid plan together that incorporates the family. So they almost have their own process that they're working, of meetings they're going to, of a support family support system, so that they aren't, kind of wrapping around the addict or the person or their loved one who would seek treatment, but they're kind of working their program as the loved one is working theirs. And as they do, then they're going to start to evolve into the same recovery processes as their loved one and be more on the same page from that aspect. So not only should we be discharging our patients with a discharge summary for them, but also a family aftercare plan that involves whoever they're kind of going to be part of this early on process. And then I think of tapping back in, I know relapse, we view that as it's part of the process and it's going to happen, but what can we do as an industry to take that aspect out? There's the monitoring piece that you had talked about of these professionals programs that do the monitoring for 2, 3, 4 years. The research is showing it works, and that should be the norm across the board. And I think it's our responsibility to create that within our treatment systems.
And Glenda, Stephanie mentioned an aftercare plan. What other strategies have you used or recommended to keep those families engaged after the treatment process?
Well, as far as strategies, once they leave your door, you don't have a lot of control over what they actually commit to or fail to stick with. I agree with Stephanie 100%. I think it needs to be a major part. I think it needs to be reminded this is a journey you're taking together, and if you want to end up in the same destination, then you will follow this path that we laid out. Oftentimes, though, I have families, those who are really invested and their loved one getting better, they're willing. They're willing to go to Al-Anon. They're willing to read books. They're willing to do weekend workshops. They're willing to stay there for the long haul. And I think, we can't force everyone to be in the action stage of change. So we have to just take it one family at a time, give them as much material as we can, every website, every resource we can come up with. And then, you could do something like a commitment plan. Let's commit. Let's look at short-term goals, long-term goals, and ask them to stick with that. I'd like for 1 second to go back, if I may, to the topic of codependency. I don't know about every other places in the country, but particularly in the South, one of the things that I have found that I've had to talk to people about is that they look at codependency and they think, well, wait a minute, you're telling me not to be who I am, because they think dependency or that self-sacrifice is a great thing. And sometimes we have to ask them, what's the secondary gain out of that? What do you get? I know from my own personal experience, codependency, I've got the trophy at home, that, you know, I came to a place in my life where I had to say, you know, what I'm doing, my self-sacrifice was self-martyring, and somehow that fed me in some way. I got something, I felt as though I got something good out of that. Made me feel good about me. So ultimately, codependency, in my opinion, goes back to self-esteem. If you help them increase their self-esteem, they're going to start seeing that it's okay for me to say no and for me to set that boundary. So I just want to put that out there, please. Thank you.
Caroline?
I think a big technical term for codependency is pathological altruism. It's sick giving. And there is usually a secondary gain. But when it's really a struggle. I mean, I have a son who's in recovery for alcoholism. And so as his mom and as a professional in this field, I know what it feels like on both sides. So what message am I sending if I do something for that person they can do for themselves? I'm saying, sort of in a covert way, I don't think you can do this. And so we do handicap and cripple them with that over-loving, that enmeshment. I love acronyms, so I'm just going to give you a couple that I love. Denial, don't even notice I am lying. And relationship, really exciting love affair turns into ongoing nightmare, sanity hangs in peril, or sobriety hangs in peril. But I've had parents that have paid the money to send a loved one to treatment, and they offer them drugs on the way home. The parent brought drugs to offer. Or I'm thinking of a family that I worked with in London. They sent their son to a treatment center in the States. The son came back, really motivated to recover. The parents were having a party, and there was cocaine present. And the son is like, well, and this is an adult son, why are you expecting behavior that's different than your modeling? So there's, you know, I think, Glenda, it was you that said some families are serious, some aren't.
Which takes us back to what Sifra was saying about the aftercare, the importance of the aftercare plan. You know, I use my telephone when I'm talking to people, and I say, you see this phone right here? I can give it to you. But if you don't pick it up and use it, it's not going to serve you any purpose. So you have to develop a plan that they're willing to commit to. Well, if I'm recommending X and you're only willing to commit to Y, well, then, hey, I'm going to go with Y, because I'm going to take whatever you put on the table that you're going to stick with, and then my hope is that you'll go to X next. If this is not working for you, so I very much believe in a plan B. Let's work on plan A, and that's fine, but I want to have a backup plan. If plan A is not working for you, then let's find out. Let's move to, are you willing to say plan A is not working? We need to go to plan B.
Well, the families in that crisis stage get their commitment then. They want their loved one to do whatever it takes, and so we need to have them commit that they will do whatever it takes and for the long haul.
I do want to leave some time for some questions from our audience. Any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our audience before we take some of their questions? Okay.
I just want to say, wow, I'm so grateful that you guys are here, because we need each other in this huge disease facing our globe. And so it's an honor for me to sit here and see your faces and know that we're on this together. We're all pulling in the same direction.
Absolutely. Are there any questions from our audience? Right back. Do I get to be Oprah?
Thanks. I'm Oscar Carr with the Experiential Healing Center. I had a question about Al-Anon, right? It was 55 minutes in before I first heard the mention of Al-Anon, and it has been really important to my personal recovery. So how much do you all really ask your family members to go to Al-Anon meetings both before Family Week and afterwards, because I have found when I went back to graduate school, they'd send counseling students to Al-Anon meetings to come sit in and watch, and I'd always laugh and as a member of Al-Anon and say, you know, maybe y'all need to be in here as participants as opposed to observing. But anyways, that's kind of my little spiel. But how much do you really push Al-Anon, and does it work?
You know, from my perspective, from the very first phone call that comes in on our admissions team, and I have been fortunate to be part of the admissions process where I'm at, and that is one of the first things I know when I'm on the phone with the family members. It's from the very first conversation, because they need the support more than just me on the phone with them. They need to start building their support system through this, regardless of the outcome of getting their loved one into treatment or not. Whether they're able to make that move in and the loved one goes and it all works out the way we want it to, that they have started that support from the very beginning. Because they need that through this whole entire process. So I am a big believer in Al-Anon, CODA, all of those really support systems for the family members.
I agree. First conversation I can have with a family, I recommend Al-Anon. Several things may come up, like, you know, I'm not the one with the problem. They're the one with the problem. And so, you know, therapy is all about positive manipulation in a way. So I'll use manipulation, guilt trip, whatever I have to do to get them there. And so I really tell them, you know, Al-Anon is for the family. You've got someone who struggles. You need a support system. And so if I get them to do it for selfish reasons, that's fine. And I also tell them, now, you may not like the first meeting you go to. You know, it's kind of like churches. I might go to this church and I don't like it. So do I just quit going? No, you just find another one. So I tell them it's okay to Al-Anon meeting hop for a while until they can find one that fits them, until they feel like they can connect. Because if they can't have that original connection and build that relationship with the support system we want them to have, then it's not serving them any purpose. But the main thing is not wanting them to give up, to keep going. And it is helpful if they actually do it.
We reinforce Al-Anon from day one, especially when we've got family members. And when it's family members, we encourage them to go. We tell them what to expect. We give a meeting list. But when it's a marriage and it's some people that are – the example I usually give and like to say is – that I believe all of us attract and are attracted to as healthy as we are. So if I go into AA and I start growing spiritually and I stay sober and the other person's not doing anything, that attraction, whatever pulled us together, is too far apart. And the odds are already against them anyway. And that's something you've got to grow together if you want the relationship to stay together.
I truly believe in the 12-step as integral, and I know that we ask our family members during family week, before they get there, we suggest it, but then it's also important to say we not only want you to be a regular attending, and I always ask people to go at least four times before they say that group's not for them, but I ask them to get a temporary sponsor right away, And just to go to the leader, you know, the person facilitating, and just say, I need a temporary sponsor for this week. And then to actually commit to work the steps in that 12-step program.
Time for one more question. Oh, right behind you, Lori.
Oh. I'm just curious. I work in a correctional facility. I work in a prison with addicts. And the main thing that I'm trying to get these guys to do is trust again. How do you get a family member to trust somebody who's, number one, broken the law, that's out of control in their eyes, stolen from them, used them, manipulated them? How do you get that family to reinvest in this person once they get these recovery skills to go back out in society?
Walter, I'm going to let you start. We talked a little bit about that.
You're not going to be able to make that happen while they're there. While they're incarcerated, it's just not going to happen. The only way that I believe it can happen is once the person is released from the correctional facility, and if that person, that patient goes out and changes their life, gets involved in this 12-step program, seeks their own counseling, gets a job, and from a distance, the family members see, oh, wow, he's been out 3 years. He hadn't been arrested again. He's working. He's showing up for holidays. He's not intoxicated or drunk or high or what. That is, after they see that for a while, then you start getting little pieces of trust a little bit at a time, and it takes a long time. It's not going to happen while they're there.
Can I address the trust issue? Because that's really foundational. There'll be blame. I mean, that's just kind of a secondary. Resentment is anger in a party dress. Trust, but verify. I think that verification is extremely important. Don't trust what people say. Trust what they do. And so random UAs... I know I've heard it said that there's three ways basically that intervene. It would be the liver, the lawyer, or the lover. And working with people that have had sexual betrayal, there's nothing better than a lie detector test every, 3 to 6 months, or annually for the next 5 years. So trust but verify.
Did you have a question? So that's all the time we have. We're ready for lunch, but I would like to thank our panelists who provided a great conversation this afternoon. I'd also like to thank you, members of the Memphis Addiction Treatment and Recovery Community, for coming out today. We sincerely appreciate it, and we hope that next time we're in town, you'll welcome us back. And also please join me in thanking our sponsors, Dominion Diagnostics, Foundations Recovery Center, Pine Grove, Mirror Lake Recovery Center. Thank you all so much. Lunch will be served momentarily.